Hello, everyone. I was asked to lead a discussion on gauge invariant quantities and discovered in the schedule that it's also a discussion on PN, which I'm not really qualified to lead. I just want to run through some impressionistic slides to sort of get people thinking about what we're talking about. Of course, I think one of the first things that sticks out in my head when I think about the invariant quantities is this paper by Detweiler, who pointed out that when we consider conservative circular orbits in Schwarzschild, where we have a helical Killing vector, suddenly many quantities are at least perturbatively gauge invariant, including this famous redshift factor. And there's this very nice comparison between cell force results and post-Newtonian theory. This is one of many, many different kinds of invariant quantities which have been identified and used over the years to compare between codes, between theories, and to numerical relativity. Of course, another one that followed soon after Detweiler's paper was that the ISCO shift was compared by Mark Favada to various post-Newtonian resummations, as well as effective one-body models. A really important, I think, part of this story was the identification of the periastron shift of nearly circular orbits as another gauge invariant quantity, which could be compared both to theory and even to numerical relativity simulations. The story continues to build over time, and this is not meant to be at all complete. Just a few of some of the earlier works, and certainly not even probably the very first work, but leading on from studies of redshift and the first law of black hole mechanics led to studies of the binding energy. Another important step was the identification of further structures, if you will, on the small body, which could then be used to create gauge invariant quantities. For example, this paper by Dolan et al. Identified the rate of spin precession on a circular orbit as another invariant quantity, and followed up with tidal invariant quantities in a similar vein, of which this was sort of kind of the dipole order, and then we move on to the tidal invariants. The redshift studies have led into further investigations of connections to the surface gravity. In particular, this is a really nice combination analytic work, as well as numerical relativity comparison to initial data sets. And then just last session, my student showed some comparisons of the redshift factor through the surface gravity to numerical relativity simulations. I think some of the most exciting things happening in this area right now are, of course, the applications of these ideas to what's going to be coming next. So in particular, the very first second order cell force results were to compute the binding energy of quasi-circular orbits and compare that to, of course, post-Newtonian theory. This also provides now a prediction at the second order in cell force, which can be compared to other codes, potentially to numerical relativity simulations. And then finally, I think we now have to start thinking about the waveforms as another of these invariant quantities. This is the thing that we're really interested in, of course. The waveform is really nicely a true gauge invariant quantity. It's something you can measure at infinity and understand. And this really nice work is a comparison between a sort of self-force, a self-force expansion, the post-adiabatic expansion, to numerical relativity simulations. And as second order continues to develop, and as we talked about yesterday, even as people begin to construct different first order waveforms, this will be an important point of comparison. So there are many successes in the story of invariants. For one thing, they've been used to predict very high order post-Newtonian quantities. It's allowed for people to develop confidence in their codes. You can compare gauge invariant quantities across codes and confirm that the codes are correct. And in the first place, the results themselves can be compared to post-Newtonian theory, giving further confidence that nothing terrible has gone wrong in the calculations. There's been a huge amount of connection to the effective one-body model, allowing it to be calibrated at the very high mass ratio. And that in turn has fed into waveform models and gravitational wave data analysis. And I think the very hunt for invariant quantities and deeper studies of them have led to a lot of theoretical advancements, such as further understanding of the first law of black hole mechanics and so on. So that's enough of that. I have two slides now. One can spark discussion for where people think we want to go in the future. And the other one can spark discussion about what some of the challenges are. So yesterday, an NRAR style code comparison was suggested. And then Jonathan Thornburg immediately followed up and said, well, wouldn't the redshift quantity be a natural first check? And indeed, I think invariant quantities would be a natural first check on these kinds of code comparisons, leading then into waveform comparisons. People are developing new invariants, such as invariants related to black hole scattering, and also more invariants related to the precession of spins. And on the horizon, I'm sure there'll be more connections to the post-Newtonian effective one-body theory. We heard one such talk about that, which really brought together every aspect, I think, of post-Minkowski, post-Newtonian, effective one-body, scattering all together to further calibrate effective one-body models using self-force results. And also, I think it'll be interesting to discuss where these are going as second-order self-force sort of starts to open up. And so I'll go ahead and stop there, and let's see if there are any comments, questions, or discussion points so far.
I can say something if no one else wants to. With the setting of the second order, we've been looking a bit more recently at these comparisons with numerical relativity, and of course others have as well. Those comparisons are certainly quite subtle, I think, and I don't know much about numerical relativity, and it's something I'd love to understand more about. So, for instance, in the talk, that Sergey, your student, presented today, I saw that into the SSX simulations, you had some oscillations that you kind of averaged out related to the center of mass. Maybe this is a bit technical, but I'm just wondering, is that the right thing to do? Just kind of average out those oscillations? There's more than one way to average things. We're kind of reaching the level of comparison where you might be worried about doing that correctly.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, Sergey can jump in if he wants to say anything. I would just say that when the oscillations about a quantity are small enough, basically they're sinusoidal in an expansion. And so an average that just shoots through the middle of the amplitudes, a time average, they're all the same up to a fairly high degree of precision. But as you say, that's not necessarily good enough if we want to go for really high precision. And in fact, if one considers the case of the orbital frequency with eccentric modulations on it, as Tony showed today, just shooting a line through the middle between the amplitude and the amplitude is wrong. You have to do a time average. Unfortunately, we don't have a robust theory for where these oscillations are coming from. We just see that they're really well correlated with the center of mass motion. So there is a lot more to be understood about these simulations, where some of these subtle effects come from. Eric, you have a hand up.
Right. I mean, Niels is asking a question that I wanted to ask in perhaps a bit broader terms. I mean, it's something that's always bugged me, and I never understand why comparisons to numerical relativity work so well, because it always seems to me that there should be huge issues of systematic mismatch between, you know, for example, what you mean by M1 and M2 in your numerical simulation, and what you mean by M1 and M2 in your self-force calculation. In Sergey's talk, there was a remark to the effect that the frequency that was being used was the coordinate time frequency of the numerical simulation. And that, I guess, was compared to the, you know, frequency of the self-force calculation. Why does that work? I mean, I don't see any reason why this should work so easily, so well. And, you know, at some point, there ought to be issues of, you know, systematically establishing the map between a numerical simulation and a post-Newtonian calculation or a self-force calculation. And, you know, I periodically ask a question, and most oftentimes people just wave their hands, but I never get satisfied. So, I mean, I don't want to dwell on this issue, but, you know, what do you do, people? You people, what do you do to convince yourself that, you know, everything should work? I mean, everything works out straightforwardly like it seems to.
Yeah. Martin, were you going to chime in?
I'm going to chime in what we do to, as Because I have the same concern as you, Eric. And for that reason, all the quantities that we actually use for the comparison are things that are directly extracted from the waveform at infinity. In principle, if we understand our self-force calculation correctly, we should be able to produce a waveform at infinity from self-force calculation. And if we understand our NR correctly, we should be able to produce a waveform at infinity.
Yeah, so
and
I agree.
It's the same observable quantity.
Right. So if I agree with that. So if you constructed something that can be measured and is directly observable two different ways, they should compare. What I'm surprised with is that's typically not what is being done, and often it's not what's being done, but it seems still to work a lot, to work a lot better than it should. So that's where I get fascinated.
Yeah, no, and I've put, so first of all, for open challenges, I think this is exactly what you're pointing out, Eric, which is that these are really only quasi invariants. They are only invariant under perturbation theory, first of all, and then under restricted classes of perturbative gauge transformation. So it becomes very hard to be confident in what's going on or necessarily why it works. Now, what I would say is that I totally agree with you, Eric. One really interesting open problem is, I think, really constructing an appropriate mapping. The easiest, most straightforward thing is what Martin just said. If you believe that your waveforms are being correctly extrapolated to infinity, those should be gauge invariant. If you understand your observers, your BMS frame in infinity, which itself is a not necessarily trivial problem, then everything should be good to go. But that limits what you can study. You can really only study waveform and fluxes. Maybe that's all we really care about, but you can't study local quantities like the redshift factor, the spin precession, and so on. So I think Alex is good to weigh in on this, but first George had a hand up. So let's take George first.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of experience with numerical relativity, but I have a lot of experience with numerical modeling of thunderstorms and lots of other computational aspects. And one of the things that I find in those communities is that there's no real systematic approach to the error analysis that they're doing. And that I think that's something that needs to be looked at here as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think since numerical codes are, universally adaptive mesh refined, doing clean resolution studies is not always easy, especially not of waveforms. And on top of that, the post-processing of these quantities introduces a variety of choices, all of which need to be studied a little bit. And so that's yet another problem from the numerical side. And people have tried to incorporate that. That's where these error bars come from a lot of the time, is trying to understand the effects of resolution as well as the effects of the post-processing choices. Alex, you have a hand up.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me? So I guess I also share Eric's concern, but I wanted to maybe point out that some comparisons are a bit less tricky than others, even if they don't rely on the gravitational waveform. For instance, some such comparisons were performed using a notion of total energy and angular momentum, which can be really cleanly defined at infinity. And also in some specific contexts, like if you have an approximate helical symmetry, you have a well-defined notion of angular velocity of the orbit, as Aaron knows very well. And also, if you have a co-rotating system, for instance, you have a notion of surface gravity. So those things are defined invariantly, geometrically. So I think they are less tricky maybe than orbital frequencies. And also concerning the mass, to what extent are we sure that the notion of mass that we use, say in post-Newtonian theory, maybe that enters, in a skeleton model as some constant in front of a monopolar energy momentum denser? To what extent is it obvious that that should correspond to, say, the baryonic mass of a neutron star or the irreducible mass of a black hole? Maybe it's not so obvious, but it seems to me that based on the kind of arguments that Adam uses, for instance, to show that the redshift, you know, has to coincide in some sense to the surface gravity using match asymptotic expansion. I guess maybe it should be possible to cleanly make such a map that Eric is looking for between different notions of mass, different notions and spins, and so on.
Yeah, I'll take Chair's prerogative before I call on Harold. I think that question, Eric, is of course very interesting. We use the area and the spin of the black hole, which are measured locally to the apparent horizons, to define their masses. And I suppose one needs to show through a calculation that those definitions correctly map onto the self-force definitions. Now, my understanding was by studying these things out to second order, where you really need to worry about some of this stuff, it has been understood that the map, that the area can be used as the mass of the small body and so on and so forth. So those things certainly need to all be accounted for. Harold, you have a comment or question?
Yeah, I must simply say I agree with everything that was said, starting with Eric Poisson, that there is no really good reason why the numerical calculations agree so well with everything else, given all the coordinate dependent choices that go on in them in so many different places. From the numerical side, things like the area of the horizon or the magnitudes of the spin are found to be remarkably constant, even though they are defined in coordinate dependent ways. The spin direction must much less so. And using the waveforms also requires a lot of attention and care. As Leo says in the chat, one really needs the BMS charges to control the waveforms well enough in order to make detailed precision comparisons. But perhaps this is just my numerical relativity experience, but I'm also surprised the opposite way around. For instance, the redshift comparisons that Sergei showed earlier today, why are they working so well from the from the analytical side? Because there's also approximations on the analytical side, existence of a helical killing vector that is not satisfied, but nevertheless, it seems to be working really well.
Sergi, do you want to comment on that? Otherwise, I can comment on something.
Yeah, go ahead. You first. Yeah.
You know, I'm not. Sergi's tried a lot of different fits, and I almost think that they're we're not getting the match I hope, actually. So what's really nice is that like with your work with Martin, when you do a fixed frequency multiple mass ratio fit, you get clean fits that seem to work very well. And perhaps that's itself is surprising given all of the ambiguities. On the flip side, you can see here that the fits generally start to diverge before ISCO, even though they are then a mass ratio series. And those kinds of errors are difficult to understand. I think we also have to consider where our level of, you know, remarkably good fit is, right? If a part in 1,000 sounds fantastic, then we're at a part in 1,000 and it's fantastic. On the flip side, the 3PN correction to the redshift factor is like a part in 1,000. So is that kind of accuracy impressive or not good enough to really tease out the information we want to know? I'm not sure. So I guess that's just to say that it's not clear that these are as amazing as they are, but from the perspective of the analytic behavior, I think it is kind of remarkable that the zeroth order is easy to achieve and fits very well. So in the chat, by the way, Lee had asked if I had a reference for the fact that the mass of the smaller black hole was through an asymptotic matching shown to be the same as the aerial mass of the small black hole in the matching scheme. If anyone has a reference for that, that would be great. I thought that is exactly how one read off the structure of the test body, and that should provide a straightforward mapping. Sam.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Harold or anyone else. I mean, maybe this is too far afield, but it just struck me. You said you need the BMS charges to make precision comparison. I mean, I guess my understanding is the BMS frame has the super translation ambiguity, but that's a free function on the sphere. So how are, I mean, are you, you have a free function of freedom before you compare waveforms? What did you exactly mean by that?
Does anyone who has been working on the connections to BMS and CellForce want to comment? Or Leo?
I mean, I can just comment on the following that, of course, if we're considering just an individual detector that is approximately on Scry and following, you know, D by DU, then you're right. We don't care about BMS. But since most of the time what we're doing is taking modally decomposed waveforms and trying to match them between different calculations, usually, you know, we do care about the BMS freedom. So in particular, if we want to do comparisons between NR and at early times post-Newtonian, then, you know, it's not just a time shift. We have essentially a function's worth of angle dependent time shifts.
No, I agree. It has to be there in principle. I'm just surprised to hear people are already doing it because it sounds like it's got to be incredibly hard.
Well, I mean, yeah, check out the link that I put in there. Yeah, we're actually doing this, and I think we will need to do this for hybridization. But I mean, I don't know where else this is going to appear because I don't know. Anyway, yeah, I'll let other people talk about it.
Well, presumably what holds true for a proper matching to PN will one day hold true for any kind of proper matching to CellForce results. So, you know, once again, you'll want to make sure that you are talking about the same asymptotic frame if you're doing some kind of mode by mode decomposition of the waveform, which we all inevitably do.
Yeah, just to expand a little bit more on Leo, and coming back to the theme that Aaron started, all of this depends on what precision do you care about. In the precision of the numerical relativity codes a few years ago, the BMS things wouldn't show up at all as noticeable. But especially with the new CCE codes that are coming along, there is a distinct lack of consistency, definitely noticeable and numerically resolved lack of consistency between different ways of computing the spherical gravitational wave modes that can only be resolved when with the appropriate BMS transformation. There's a few very good papers coming out of Cornell and Caltech in the last few months about this. Another point where all of this plays into is waveform models. So there's PN, EOB, fixed high, fitted higher order terms, whatnot, non-quasi-circular correction being put in EOB models. There's a humongously big machinery being built up. But somewhere at the bottom of this machinery, there is an identification between numerical relativity masses and spins and the masses and spins that go into the models. And if that identification is wrong, then the models will still fit something to agree with numerical relativity, but there might be systematic biases coming in through that channel. For instance, if comparisons to numerical relativity are then used to argue that certain ways of writing EOB are more natural and should be preferred.
Okay, if no one else is jumping in, I'll just bring it back to the Capra stuff. It just occurs to me, I mean, you're talking about the level of precision we need. Well, the story in Capra certainly is we need some incredibly precise waveforms for LISA to track the phase to a radian over 5 years or whatever it is. So doesn't that mean the LISA waveforms, like when we actually match, whoever does it, a waveform bank of waveform templates to the LISA data stream, doesn't that bank of waveform templates need the full super translation ambiguity as parameters to make sure it gets the match of the BMS frame of LISA? That sounds daunting.
Well, but again, as Leo pointed out, you're really interested in the imprint of the waveform on a single detector, which sits at a single sky location. And I think in some ways, the BMS story then reduces to things like relative velocity between the observer and the emitter.
That's just the Poincaré part of BMS. I mean, we don't know that the frame of LISA is the same frame you guys use, BMS frame you guys used in your EMRI calculations, right?
Well, that's a good point.
Just like the bank of waveform templates has to have stuff in there like relative motion between source and detector. Absolutely. We all agree on that, right? Well, it seems to me it also has to have the full BMS super translation, a free function on the sphere.
No, because you need to evaluate that function on the sphere only in one direction, the direction to Earth.
Yeah, but how do you know what the direction is?
Direction are two of your parameters in your search, and that should specify your BMS frame. Well, up to movement away.
You're telling me the BMS freedom can be reduced to a parameter? That doesn't sound right.
Oh, you know the direction to the source, so you know where you are on the sphere. You don't have any ambiguity there.
So we're getting far away from cell force and Kappa here, but another parameter that is in the waveform matching is the time of arrival. So in some sense, the BMS freedom will then manifest itself in some correlation between time of arrival and the orientation inclination of the source. But then there's some small correlation if the waveform model is off and gives different BMS frames in different sky directions.
Well, I think one, well, we don't have to go on about this, but I think one challenge though in support of what Sam is concerned about is, as I understand it, a BMS transformation can mode mix the various LM modes. And we know we need to go to high LM modes. And those are then going to be described as a sum of angular functions. And in order to make sure those angular functions sum up properly at a fixed theta phi, in other words, to get the relative amplitudes and phases of every LM mode correctly accounted for, that might be something where you need to know what you're doing. I think in the end though, there are some things about the BMS, which is a bit unphysical in some sense, right? I mean, what we really care about is we care about an asymptotic observer who is inertial and measuring time with their own proper time. And you need to understand the frame in which you're doing the cell force calculations, but I would assume that there is a way to just figure out what a given observer at a fixed location far from the source can measure if they travel on a line that's inertial with their own proper time as the measurement, and then of course perhaps a relative velocity. But if we want to come back to the quasi-invariance, I think, again, coming back to what Eric was saying, for the NR comparisons, this is, I think, still fuzzy. And those things that have worked, I think, as Alex was saying, have relied on symmetries or approximate symmetries that kind of protect them. Or, as Martin was saying, have really focused on quantities at infinity, which up to some ambiguities, which are perhaps a little better controlled, right, are then very much gauge invariant and something people can agree on. But I'm curious, when one now goes towards second order, the post-adiabatic expansion also introduces the same kind of symmetry breaking, the same kind of time dependence, the same kind of slicing dependence that numerical relativity simulations might have. So is anyone in the working on second order, can you comment, are there any challenges or conceptual issues that might arise in doing quasi-invariant calculations in second order, because we might want to again use these for first checks of codes and results, and in fact that's what's been done with the binding energy. Let's see, I could just see if Adam or Niels or Barry, you just list names of people that are on the call and maybe not listening.
Adam is busy marking now, I can tell you
from no. The
exchange that I'm having now with him. I'm his veteran on his course, so we are both Heavily engaged.
The students must come first. Andrew, do you have a comment?
I guess I can briefly talk about something that we'll talk about tomorrow. So we've come up with a method for fixing for calculating the gauge transform from any gauge to the Bondi-Sachs gauge, and also fixing the BMS frame at first order. So this will be enough to calculate a gauge invariant second order quantity, Psi4-2, which doesn't depend on the second order gauge transform. So this will be hopefully useful for comparing our results.
So Psi4 is in the Weyl scalar and the second order part of the Weyl scalar? Okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
I guess to Aaron, your question is difficult to answer, but I think every time we try to do a comparison, we get down to a point where things don't quite agree. So that happened with the binding energy that we agreed to a couple of PN orders. And then essentially we had to give up on trying to get better agreement. I mean, we do have dissipation included in our calculation necessarily. I think we just about have all the slow time contributions now included. It's not easy to turn them off and create a perfectly conservative system in our second order calculation. So that's certainly something that makes it challenging to compare to post-Newtonian, for example. I think we tried once and got nonsense out.
So is the proper comparison point then post-Newtonian with dissipation? Because I was under the impression that those effects are themselves a higher PN order than maybe what's been calculated so far.
I think with the binding energy, maybe Niels or maybe Alex can say, I think it was about where we were seeing the difference.
Okay. Alex?
With a couple of PN orders in.
Starting at 4 PN order, then I think it's natural that there should be a difference between the post-Newtonian binding energy and the second order perturbative binding energy that you've computed, because the post-Newtonian binding energy at 4 PN order would include tail terms, which in the post-Newtonian framework are computed from basically a quasi-conservative system, like a tail integral, which is symmetric by exchange t goes to minus t. And it's most likely not coinciding with the Bondi mass at that order. One would then need to somehow, in the post-Newtonian framework, compute a quantity that is similar to the perturbative quantity instead of the perturbative calculation trying to match the post-Newtonian calculation.
So that raises a question for me. Does that mean that the 4 PN tail terms in the method that they're being computed are not really the appropriate things for gravitational wave predictions? Because I would think that the gravitational wave case needs to be the one that has dissipative boundary conditions.
Well, up to 3.5 PN order, there is a nice clean split between odd parity, I always mix even and odd. one over C squared is odd, even.
Pick one, it doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, there's a clean split between purely conservative and purely dissipative effects, depending on the power in 1 over C. And starting at 4 PN, that breaks down. It doesn't necessarily mean that, like, the 4 PN binding energy that's computed is irrelevant to compute the gravitational waveforms. I don't think it is. I think it because it the way it's the in the post-Newtonian framework, at least so far, the gravitational wave phase has been computed using an argument of energy balance, which tells you that the rate of change of the energy has to match the gravitational flux. And so until 3.5 PN order, it's clear it has to work, this argument, because of this nice split between conservative and dissipative effects. At 4pn order, maybe there could be an issue there. I don't know. I've not thought about it. But what is certain is that so far, one is basically assuming the energy balance to derive the phasing, simply because one is not capable to directly compute the phasing out of the equations of motion, because to get, for instance, a 3.5pn accurate motion that includes all the dissipation to that order, one we need to basically go to 6pn order in the equations of motion, which is really hard. And so instead one uses this energy balance in which it is then understood that the mechanical binding energy should somehow correspond to the Bondi mass. And that has been proven up to some post-Newtonian order. It's been used up to higher post-Newtonian order, assumed basically. But will this break down at some order? Maybe. I don't know. I don't know if this has been addressed in general.
Very interesting. Yeah, I remember when I was first looking at the redshift factor, I was told in several contexts that 5pn was the place where these kinds of specific ambiguities would become problematic. I hadn't realized that, in fact, the issues may start to crop up at 4pn through these tail effects. So that's really interesting. But I think that does then complicate the picture of, you know, how, as we push forward to ever more precision comparisons and ever more precision checks, what's going to be done. For example, if the 4pn binding energy is not the one to calculate for the binding energy calculation at second order in cell force, it's depicted here, I'm sure that makes the people that calculated this data unhappy, right? And it's hard to know for sure you got everything right without those kinds of comparisons to help. So yeah, perhaps there's a developments to be made on many fronts here.
May I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
So regarding the comparison, I think maybe something else that could be done instead of relying on high PN calculation could be to improve the first law by including dissipation. One of the reasons why the agreement is clearly not perfect, maybe because the first law is really assuming an exactly helically symmetric space-time.
Yeah.
While clearly the perturbative calculation does not. It's a real inspiring system. And there are a couple of ideas about how one might include dissipation into the first law to basically capture the small radial kinetic energy due to the actual in spiral. And maybe with such an improved first law with dissipation, that would still involve the redshift at first order, I imagine, one could correct for this, and maybe the agreement could improve.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting to me and to Sergi, who's wanted to think about this as well. And I know Sergi's also been interested in incorporating the transition into plunge, which is another place where radial motion suddenly becomes important and which may be key for simulations. So maybe we can all chat. Leo, you have a hand up.
Yeah, this is just to follow up on the failure of there being a helical killing vector field. Is I think that it's actually an approximate symmetry, even for systems where it shouldn't be an approximate symmetry. In particular, just when we're focusing on quasi-circular orbits, I say this just based on numerical relativity data. And I have a student who's trying to do some analytical calculations to justify this right now. But the point is that even when we look at systems that we know shouldn't even have helical killing vector fields because they have spin precession and stuff, there's still an at least based on the radiative data at Scry Plus, it seems like there's still an approximate killing vector field that's satisfied to a sufficiently, well, to some very high level. And right. So, I mean, you can just see this in the data, and what we're trying to do right now is just to understand analytically how well this approximate killing vector field, the killing equation is satisfied or not.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Yeah, I wonder if this isn't connected just to the fact that there is a two time scale expansion, roughly speaking, at all. That, in other words, there is a frame in which the orbital motion that's fast can more or less be nullified, leaving only the slow drift of the objects towards each other.
Yeah, it does fail for eccentric orbits, of course, but for quasi-circular orbits, it's fine.
Okay, interesting. We only have a few minutes left. We've talked now about some of the challenges. Maybe in the last few minutes, if anyone has a comment on where they think things may be going in the future, I think in particular, we'll hear about scattering coming up, which I know is a relatively new and exciting area for all of these comparisons to arise. Any other news on second order? So it was mentioned that there would be a Psi-4 comparison coming up. I don't know if anyone wants to make any claims or promises, but any other quasi-invariants that people might be working on for second order?
So tomorrow I'll present our first results for the flux.
Awesome.
Quasi-invariant, comparison that of NR. And the reason I asked the initial question is precisely because we can see sometimes the errors possibly dominated by the NR simulations and not our results. But nothing yet on local invariants.
Yeah, I think there are still a lot of technicalities and challenges in dealing with waveforms and numerical relativity, which, you know, people have been hard at work on improving and fixing, but depending on which waveforms you're grabbing, can be limiting. Someone also, I think, mentioned other spin precession angles, moving on to tilts of spins. I don't remember who had said that earlier, but does anyone want to comment on that?
I think I mentioned that during my overview talk. Mm-hmm. It's not clear to me that any of these would result into actual gauge invariant observables. But on the other hand, one thing that should happen is that there should be a forking action on your spins that either aligns or misaligns your spin with your orbital angular momentum. And that certainly has a qualitative impact in what's happening.
Yeah, that would be a dissipative effect, right? Because it would slowly change some of the conserved quantities, or?
Yes, I guess so.
Interesting. All right, well, not sure what else to say. I think, Eric, I appreciate that you raise those concerns frequently, because I think we need to be reminded of them. And I think this is a bit sometimes of a mystery still, quote unquote, why all of the comparisons work out so well.
Yeah, it sure is interesting to see how robust it all is.